A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a Herman special. He wants a playbook for a very specific kind of social trolling while traveling. The persona, you're not just a tourist. You're a tourist who appears to be operating under some kind of counter-surveillance discipline, like you're in the crosshairs of a malign international plot, taking methodical steps to avoid being watched. The challenge is calibration. Too subtle, nobody notices. Too overt, and you just look unwell. Daniel wants concrete mannerisms, behaviors, cues, the full tactical menu. And he wants it to be fun.
This is exactly my kind of prompt. And I want to be clear about what we're actually building here. This is not a guide to real operational security. This is theater. It's borrowing the vocabulary of spycraft and wearing it as a costume. The goal is to create what I'd call calibrated ambiguity, behaviors that could be read as either professional tradecraft or harmless eccentricity, leaving anyone who notices genuinely uncertain which one they're looking at.
It's cosplay with a straight face. The spy who came in from the poolside bar.
And the reason this works at all is that the mannerisms are rooted in real techniques. There's a kernel of authenticity that observers subconsciously recognize, even if they can't name what they're seeing. So let's start with the actual tradecraft, because you can't perform the theater convincingly unless you understand what the real thing looks like.
Right. Otherwise, you're just a guy who keeps tying his shoe and looking anxious, which, to be fair, is also a persona.
A less glamorous one. So the foundational concept in counter-surveillance is something called dry cleaning. This is documented in declassified CIA training manuals. It's a set of maneuvers designed to determine whether you're being followed. The core idea is that if someone is tailing you, they have to follow your movements. So you introduce movements that no normal person would make, and you watch to see who mirrors them.
The name dry cleaning, is that because you're cleaning your route of surveillance?
That's the idea, yes. The classic moves, you double back on your own path, you make sudden direction changes, you use reflective surfaces to scan behind you without turning your head. The key thing about real dry cleaning is that it's fluid. A trained operator does these things seamlessly. The shoe tie, the window glance, the abrupt turn into a shop. They all flow together without obvious pauses.
Which is exactly where the theatrical version diverges. The pause is the whole point.
That's it. That's the entire art form right there. In real counter-surveillance, you don't want the surveillance team to know you're looking for them. In theatrical counter-surveillance, you want the bartender, the hotel clerk, the guy at the next table to notice that you're looking for someone, so you introduce a beat. A half-second delay, just enough to register as deliberate.
Walk me through the shoe tie. This is the one everyone thinks of.
Real dry cleaning, you're walking through an airport terminal, you stop, kneel down, tie your shoe, and while you're down there, you scan the corridor behind you through your legs. It's a legitimate technique because it gives you a low-angle view that's hard for a tail to anticipate. The whole thing takes maybe 8 seconds, and then you're up and moving again. The theatrical version, same move, but you take longer. You fumble with the lace. You do a visible head swivel, not a subtle glance, but a deliberate scan. You might even make eye contact with someone behind you, hold it for a beat, then return to your shoe. That eye contact is the tell. A real operator would never.
Because a real operator doesn't want to be seen seeing.
And that's the principle that governs every technique we're going to talk about. The theatrical version always has a tell, something that signals, I am aware I am being watched and I am taking countermeasures. The art is in making that tell subtle enough that it could be misread as just a quirky mannerism.
Let's build the menu. What else is in the toolkit?
The mirror check is probably the most accessible entry point. You pull out your phone, but instead of unlocking it, you use the black screen as a reflection surface. You tilt it at an angle to see behind you. Real operators do this constantly. It's one of the most discreet scanning techniques there is. The theatrical version, you hold the tilt a half second too long. You squint slightly at the screen, as if you're studying something in the reflection. Maybe you angle it left, then right, like you're sweeping the room. Anyone watching you will register that you're not checking notifications, you're checking something behind you.
The beauty of this one is that it's deniable. If someone calls you on it, you're just looking at your phone, like everyone else in the airport.
That deniability is crucial. Every technique in this playbook needs a plausible civilian explanation. The mirror check is checking your phone. The shoe tie is tying your shoe. The wrong floor gambit is just being absent-minded. If anyone confronts you directly, you have an out.
All right, the wrong floor gambit. This is the elevator one?
You're in a hotel. You get in the elevator, you press a floor, say the 7th, the doors close. Then, after a moment, you press another floor, say the 4th, and when the doors open, you exit and walk briskly down the hall. Real operators do this to flush a tail. If someone follows you out on the 4th floor, you know they're not a guest heading to their room. The theatrical version, as you press the 2nd button, you mutter something. Or, not today. Something just audible enough that the other person in the elevator hears it. Then you exit with purpose, like you've made a tactical decision.
Not today is a nice touch. Vaguely threatening, completely ambiguous.
It's the verbal equivalent of the half-second pause. It signals intentionality. You're not just confused about which floor your room is on, you've changed your plan because of something you've noticed. And the other person in the elevator is left wondering what that something was.
What about props? Daniel mentioned this is a blank canvas. I assume at some point you graduate from mannerisms to objects.
Props are where this gets really fun, but they're also where the risk of overdoing it is highest. The principle is, one prop at a time. A single well-chosen object is far more effective than a full kit. If you're walking around with a burner phone, a military folded map, a notebook in code, and a concealed earpiece, you don't look like a savvy operator. You look like you're on your way to a convention.
The Foo Jason Bourne starter pack.
So let's talk about the burner phone, because it's probably the most iconic prop. A real burner is typically a cheap Android device with a prepaid SIM, often with a cracked screen or a worn casing, because it's disposable. The aesthetic is part of the signal. The theatrical use, you carry two phones. Your normal smartphone, which you use openly, and the burner, which you only check in specific moments. After the mirror check, after the shoe tie, after you've exited the wrong floor. You pull it out, glance at it, maybe type a short message, then put it away. The key is the contrast. One phone is your civilian life, the other is your operational life. Anyone observant will notice the two devices and draw conclusions.
If they don't notice, the whole performance is wasted. So how do you make sure they notice?
You don't hide the burner, you just don't flaunt it. You place it on the bar next to your drink, screen down. You pull it out to check something while your main phone is also visible. The juxtaposition does the work. Someone sees two phones, one of them a beat-up Android with a prepaid look, and the story writes itself.
The military fold map. I've heard you mention this before. What is it exactly?
It's a specific way of folding a map that allows one-handed reading while on the move. Field operators use it because they need to navigate without stopping and unfolding a full sheet. The fold creates a series of panels that you can flip through with your thumb. It's almost like a paper version of swiping through screens. The origami is distinctive. If you're sitting in a cafe with a map folded this way, studying it between sips of coffee, anyone who recognizes the fold will immediately categorize you differently.
For everyone else, it just looks like you're unusually committed to map reading.
Which is its own kind of signal. Who uses a paper map anymore? That alone marks you as someone operating outside normal tourist behavior. You're not following Google Maps like everyone else. You're navigating.
The notebook is the one that feels most dangerous to me. Writing in code in public seems like it crosses a line.
It can, if you're not careful about what the code actually is. The theatrical version isn't actual ciphertext. It's just handwriting that looks like shorthand from a distance. Abbreviations, symbols, arrows connecting things. Maybe a grid with letters in it. The content doesn't matter. What matters is that if someone glances at your notebook, they see structured information that isn't immediately legible. You're not writing a grocery list, you're logging something.
The prop that ties it all together, I assume, is the lobby sit.
This is the crescendo. The lobby sit is the ultimate test of the persona. You position yourself in a hotel lobby, ideally a seat with a view of the entrance and the elevators. You have a newspaper, or a book, or your notebook. And you sit there for 15 minutes. But every 2 minutes or so, you glance at the entrance. Not a furtive glance, a deliberate, rhythmic check. Real counter-surveillance involves timing these glances to patterns, but the theatrical version makes the rhythm visible. Anyone watching you will notice the pattern. Then, abruptly, you fold the newspaper, stand up, and leave, like you just received a signal.
There's something almost cinematic about that. You're essentially directing a short film in which you are the protagonist, and the people around you are unwitting extras.
That's exactly what this is. And the lobby sit works because it's a complete narrative in 15 minutes. Arrival, vigilance, departure. Anyone who noticed you will have a story to tell. There was this guy in the lobby earlier. He kept checking the door, and then he just got up and left. I think he was waiting for someone, or avoiding someone.
We've built the playbook. But you mentioned earlier that this isn't just harmless fun in all contexts. What's the actual risk here?
The risk is that security professionals are trained to look for exactly these behaviors. The TSA has a program called SPOTW, Screening of Passengers by Observation Techniques. It trains officers to identify behavioral indicators that might signal hostile intent. Unusual scanning of the environment, repeated direction changes, nervous mannerisms, these are all on their checklist. If you're performing counter-surveillance theater in an airport, you are literally doing the things that behavior detection officers are paid to notice.
You could get pulled aside and questioned.
It's happened. There was a case at Frankfurt Airport a few years ago. A traveler was performing what we'd recognize as the wrong floor gambit in a hotel elevator connected to the terminal. Hotel security noticed the repeated floor changes, the muttering, the brisk exit. They flagged him. Airport police questioned him for 40 minutes. He wasn't charged with anything. There's no law against being weird in an elevator, but he missed his flight.
That's the cautionary tale. The persona works until it works too well.
And context is everything. In a low-security environment, a cafe, a train station, a public park, this persona reads as playful, mysterious, even charming. The bartender might be intrigued. In a high-security environment, an airport, a government building, anywhere with armed security and surveillance cameras, the same behaviors read as threatening. You're not a charming eccentric anymore. You're a potential threat.
There's also a psychological dimension here that I think is worth exploring. You start performing hypervigilance, and at some point, the performance can start to feel real. The feedback loop.
This is what I find most fascinating about the whole exercise. When you perform counter-surveillance theater, you're deliberately inducing a state of heightened awareness. You're scanning rooms, tracking exits, noting who's watching you. That's not a neutral mental state. Spend an hour doing this and your amygdala is lit up like a Christmas tree. The line between performing paranoia and experiencing paranoia gets very thin, very fast.
It's method acting for the surveillance state.
And there's a concept in intelligence circles called signature management, the idea that you're actively managing how you appear to surveillance systems. But here, the audience isn't a surveillance system, it's other humans. And humans are unpredictable. You can't control what story they construct from the signals you're sending. One person sees a mysterious operator, another sees someone in psychological distress. You don't get to choose.
Which brings us to the question of why anyone would want to do this in the first place. Daniel framed it as social trolling, a way of exploring the human condition and social boundaries. I think there's something deeper going on.
I think it's about agency. Travel makes you visible in ways that can feel uncomfortable. You're in an unfamiliar place, you don't know the norms, you're being watched by security cameras, your passport is being scanned, your face is being logged. Performing counter-surveillance theater is a way of reclaiming some of that visibility and redirecting it. You're not just being watched, you're watching back. Or at least, you're creating the impression that you are.
It's performance as a form of resistance, even if the resistance is entirely imaginary.
Maybe that's enough. The surveillance state is real, but for most of us, it's also abstract. We know we're being watched, but we don't feel it moment to moment. This persona makes the watching tangible. It gives you something to push against, even if the adversary is entirely fictional.
Where does someone start? If Daniel wants to try this on his next trip, what's the entry-level move?
Start with the mirror check. It's the lowest risk technique in the playbook. You're just looking at your phone. Practice holding the tilt for that half second longer than feels natural. Do it in a cafe, not an airport. See if anyone notices. You'll probably find that most people don't. But the ones who do will give you a look that's hard to describe. A flicker of uncertainty. That flicker is the whole point.
If you want to escalate from there,
add one prop. Not the full kit, just one. The burner phone is probably the most effective single prop because it's a clear signal to anyone paying attention, but it's also completely deniable. Lots of people carry two phones. The difference is in how you use them. Keep the burner screen down on the table. Check it only after you've done a mirror scan. Create the choreography.
The most important rule.
Read the room. In a cafe in Lisbon, you're a mysterious stranger. In the security line at Heathrow, you're a problem. The persona only works if you understand the difference. The goal is to be noticed just enough, not to be the subject of a security briefing.
There's an irony here that I can't let pass. The whole point of real counter-surveillance is to avoid attention, and we just spent an entire episode designing a version of it whose entire purpose is to attract attention.
It's the fundamental paradox of the exercise. Real spies want to be invisible. Theatrical spies want to be seen being invisible. It's the difference between actually hiding and wearing camouflage to a dinner party. One is practical, the other is a statement.
The statement, I think, is what Daniel's really after. It's not about fooling anyone. It's about complicating the social script. You're a tourist, but not just a tourist. You're a person with a hidden dimension. And in an era where everyone is reduced to a passenger profile and a booking reference, there's something appealing about projecting depth, even if that depth is entirely fabricated.
The man on a mission archetype. It's inherently interesting. People want to know what the mission is. They'll never ask, but they'll wonder. And that wondering is the whole game.
What does our fascination with this persona say about us? Are we performing for imagined observers because we've internalized the surveillance state?
I think we're performing because we're bored. Travel is supposed to be adventurous, but modern travel is aggressively frictionless. You scan a QR code, you follow the signs, you sit in the designated waiting area. There's no mystery left. Counter-surveillance theater injects mystery back into the experience. It turns a layover into a scene from a novel, even if the novel only exists in your own head.
The people around you become characters in that novel without their knowledge or consent, which is either delightful or deeply problematic, depending on your perspective.
But that's true of most interesting things.
All right. So to land this, if you want to try the persona, start with the mirror check. Master the half-second delay. Add one prop. The burner phone is your best bet. Practice the lobby. Sit in a low-stakes environment before you attempt it anywhere with armed security. And above all, remember that you're playing a character. The moment you start believing the character is the moment this stops being fun and starts being something else entirely.
If you really want to commit, learn the military fold. It's a useful skill even without the theater. You can navigate with one hand and hold a coffee with the other. That's just practical.
Slavs have been doing the military fold for centuries. We invented it.
You absolutely did not invent the military fold.
Mongolian field operatives.
The Sloth Special Forces.
We were very slow, but very deliberate.
I'm not engaging with this. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The chemical compound that ants use to mark trails is called Z9-hexadecinal. The Z stands for the German word Zusammen, meaning together. A naming convention established in the 1960s by chemists who realized the molecule shape determined whether ants gathered or scattered. The first major ant pheromone conference was held in 1968 in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, then part of the Soviet Union, where researchers from 14 countries gathered to standardize pheromone nomenclature.
When together.
Hilbert, I have so many questions, and I'm not sure I want any of them answered.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumentop, for that deeply specific contribution. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Try the mirror check. Just don't do it at the airport.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your
your head. Send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.